All right, let's get rolling, y'all. And again, so where we are with respect to the course as we're flying through things is we're into management, and we just talked about the life cycle of waterfowl, shorebirds, and amphibians, how those life cycles overlap with management in the south, and when we need to think about managing those organisms in the south, and the types of habitats that we may actually manage to meet these needs. Now, what we're going to go through now is talking a little bit more about some of those needs and then different management techniques with respect to moist soil management to meet various needs. At the end, what we will do, at the end of the moist soil management lecture, what we'll do is we'll actually put up a, we'll do a management scenario where we have, for example, 6 units, and let's think about how we may manage these things for for these 3 different groups, and to make sure at least needs of those organisms are being met. Okay, and that should give you a good feel for those are the types of decisions you'll make as a manager. All right, so we're talking about wetland management, and all right, that was the outline. We got to talking about waterfowl needs and shorebird needs and amphibian needs. And we will actually, this management complex, we'll talk a little bit about in just a second, but we'll revisit it at the end of here, okay? GTR management and DUD stuff, I don't know if we'll get to GTR management today, but these will be either today or tomorrow, but these will be 2 topics probably that we'll hit tomorrow. Again, if we can get to GTR management, we'll start it today. All right, so let's just focus on what do ducks eat. And this is what we were just talking about. We can think about, but what we're going to do is we're going to put some numbers to it based on research, okay? We're going to put some numbers to it. So, all right, what do ducks eat? Ducks eat seeds and aquatic invertebrates, all right? At least dabbling ducks do. And then a lot of the diving ducks are eating aquatic plants, all right? So dabbling ducks are eating seeds and invertebrates. Now, this is some research that was done in the 80s out of University of Missouri by Dr. Mickey Heitmeyer and Lee Fredrickson. And this illustrates percent composition of the diet of waterfowl. And actually, this is specifically female mallards, but using them as a template for hens at least. And the amount of aquatic inverts versus seeds that they are consuming. And what we see here is the white portion is aquatic inverts, the maroon portion is seeds. And so this is a typical female mallard pre-laying. And so what is she doing? All right, she's eating mostly, it's about 50-50, but she's eating more of aquatic inverts, starting again to build those resources which are necessary for egg production and to begin to produce eggs. During laying, as she's laying those eggs, she is nearly entirely consuming aquatic inverts, a few seeds. All right, and again, that comes back to the protein needs. Let's talk about, again, we already talked about these life cycle events. Again, this is the period of time from April through June when birds are laying their eggs and raising their birds, raising their broods. We have egg production going on. We do have the pre-basic molt occurring. And so we have pre-basic. The pre-alternate molt, though, is actually, it's moved, it's down here. So the pre-alternate molt is down here. That's when they're getting their breeding feathers. So pre-basic molt, again, Remember that the males are going through a full body molt and a wing molt, and the females are only going through a wing molt, okay? Because they are tied up with producing eggs, which is a very high protein demanding event, just like producing feathers is. And then, of course, from the duckling standpoint, the ducklings are growing and are also, their diets would be very similar to the laying female, where they're primarily consuming aquatic invertebrates. Yeah. All right. So, bottom line is, as we already talked about and we observed by putting everything out on the board, during spring and summer, the birds are focusing, especially the hens and the ducklings, on aquatic invertebrates, okay? Highly proteinaceous foods, all right? Now, so are the males, but generally the males are more like this throughout the entire spring and summer, okay? Their diet is dominated by aquatic invertebrates as they're replacing their feathers, but it looks more like this as opposed to like this with the hens during laying. Now, post-laying, and this is when we're talking about, we're getting to the period where they are staging, where birds are starting to build energetic resources for fall migration, an extremely energetically demanding event. So they are completely shifting their diet to mostly seeds, which are high in energy, okay, and they're very abundant. So they're switching their diet to seeds. And then when we look at winter, it's almost entirely seeds. Okay, and again, that reflects that during winter, we are dealing with life cycle events that are energetically demanding. So we have fall migration that is pushing this pie chart. And then during the fall, at least for the males, there is a lot of energy that goes into courtship, and even the females, because there's a lot of males that will be chasing around. Many of the species have courtship displays, and actually they will do courtship flights together where several males will chase a female. And then there are areas where most of the species also have courtship displays that they will do more in seclusion, just swimming around the female and the males displaying to the females. The other big energetically demanding event during the winter is thermal regulation. They are homeotherms, so they need to eat lots of food to keep their body temperature up. All right, and then finally we have spring migration that still is very energetically demanding. We don't see this here or here going to completely 100% seeds, because there are still protein demands in the fall. And what are those protein demands? For the female, what's her first protein demand? It's, what's that? Well, it's invertebrates. That's what they're going after. That's right. And why are they eating inverts? Yeah, the body molt, right. Okay, so they're doing the body molt, the pre-basic body molt, okay, because they haven't completed, didn't do the pre-basic body molt here, they only did the wing molt. So early, right in this time, they're doing the pre-basic body molt, and at this time, the males, right around the same time, are doing the pre-alternate molt. Right in September, October, they are getting rid of that eclipse plumage that's very cryptic for them, and they're replacing their feathers with their brilliant breed or alternate plumage. So they're going through the pre-alternate molt. Later on in the year, once we hit right in winter, the males are done with their pre-alternate molt, and then right in here, the hens will do their pre-alternate molt, okay? So they do their pre-basic molt body, then they'll do the pre-alternate molt, and they'll replace their body feathers, okay, during winter. So again, you do see invertebrates being a component of their diets during winter, and it is important to provide areas where they can acquire aquatic invertebrates. It just doesn't necessarily need to dominate your management area, where that would be the primary focus in the breeding sites in the north. is areas that have high aquatic invertebrate production as well as nesting habitat, which generally for most of the species tends to be grassland, large expanses of prairie grasslands around wetlands, okay, or at least in pretty close proximity. Any questions? Is that pretty clear? Thing kind of set into place, okay? Feel like you could answer an essay question on that, intelligently discuss the different life cycle events and how it affect, how diet is related to those life cycle events throughout the annual cycle, okay? All right, good. Good stuff, all right. So again, protein-rich foods up here, energy-rich foods down here, and that equates into aquatic inverts and seeds. So, with that in mind, let's introduce the concept of a waterfowl habitat management complex. And the idea of complexes really was born out of the 80s, a lot of research done in the 80s and in the 90s, that recognized these physiological needs and meeting different physiological needs and social needs of birds. Okay, we're talking strictly in the fall here, and generally our complex can be thought of as being composed of, at the very late, well, there are actually five components. These are three of them. First is the moist soil wetlands, which are herbaceous wetlands that have natural plants that are producing seeds, and when they're flooded, they are excellent areas for aquatic invertebrates as well. So moist soil areas, high seed production, natural seed production, and aquatic invertebrate production. All right, we'll talk about moist soil management and how we do that. Green tree reservoirs or natural hardwood bottomland areas. Again, forested wetland areas are important. We'll talk about that when we talk about green tree reservoir management. Those areas are important. Okay, and in those areas, in the hill, there, in those areas, they are acquiring, primarily in these areas, they're acquiring aquatic inverts. Flooded hardwood bottomland areas are great for invertebrate production. And they're picking up some mast, okay? So some, for example, acorns, etc. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And this is added to the component as an important component, and that is agriculture. All right, you can incorporate food plots into your complex here, and we'll talk about the importance of doing that. But the other thing I want to stress here is that you shouldn't just rely solely on one of these triangles, and especially not this triangle. And depending on who you talk to, this is old school management is providing food plots for waterfowl, and that's it. In other words, you provide a bunch of corn and you flood it, and that's all you do for the birds. And you see a lot of areas in Tennessee and throughout the Southeast and even in other parts of the country where that's all they do, this. Okay, and that is not a healthy thing to do. It's not a smart thing to do with respect to managing for waterfowl. We'll talk about that. I'll show you some data on that based on some research out of Mississippi State. Okay, you should have these other components. In fact, I would eliminate this before I would go without any of your natural wetlands. Okay, the other natural wetland that's important that we talked about, again, this is for diving ducks, and it's also important for roosting areas for geese and waterfowl, and that is the flooded marsh component. So we're dealing with aquatic bed type systems that are a little bit deeper, but it's good not to have them too deep. This is a perfect example here where you can definitely see that you have some aquatic plant production going on. There's a lot of inverts in there. So you'll get dabbling ducks out in the middle of here just going through these submergent plants, not eating the plants, but eating the inverts. And then you'll have diving ducks that'll be eating the pond weeds and et cetera, all right? Now, yeah.
So how do these ducks actually just sit through this mud?
Okay. So we talked about that when we were doing the ID stuff. Okay. And when I handed that, I handed out a handout that showed the morphology of the bill. And I know a lot of you guys weren't here for that, but basically the duck's bill, for dabbling ducks especially, they have structures called lamellae. And they're rake-like structures, and they are sieving through mud and through vegetation, and those lamellae are pulling it out, and then they just, with their tongue, they just direct the food back to the esophagus. Yep. So, lamellae. All right. Okay. The fifth component is refuge. I'll write down lamellae here. The rake-like structures on a duck's bill. If you can't see it back there, it's L-A-M-E-L-L-A-E. All right. The fifth component, which is important, which, again, you see a lot of places that don't have this. Okay, they just have, if you have areas that are hunted, in order for you to keep birds on your area, you need to have refuge. Okay, and it's recommended that at least one-third of your area is wildlife refuge. All right, there are many TWRA areas that are, first of all, are all agriculture, and they have no refuge. So people bang at them 24/7. Well, I mean, during hunting hours. And you cannot keep birds on an area doing that. Wildlife refuges are important. They need some sanctuary. And the other thing is what you often see on areas is they'll say, okay, we'll put a quarter of our area in the wildlife refuge, and it's the junk, all right? The birds don't even want to go in there. So you need to manage your wildlife refuge with as much vigor as you do your areas that are open for public hunting. All right, yeah. You know, that is, you can. Absolutely, you can. And some refuges, some areas do that. Most often, they keep it in one area. And it tends to be, if birds are coming back to that area year after year, they tend to learn that. Although birds are very quick at finding out where there's little disturbance and where. So if it works in your management scheme, where it's best if you can actually rotate things around then that's fine. The public doesn't like to see it a lot of times because they're like, well, this is refuge this year and it's not refuge this year. I'm confused. Where do I go? Sometimes they may use it even as an excuse to go in and say, well, heck, last year this wasn't refuge, and then they're hunting a refuge. So, you know, if it works into your management scheme, absolutely you can. I think for the most part you could just have it in an area. But the other important aspect is generally if it's near the center of your area, it's better than if it's away. And that is more from a hunting standpoint, because if your refuge is in the center of an area where you have hunting around it, then you have birds that are trading back and forth, and it provides a better hunting experience than if you put your refuge all the way up on one side and the birds just stay there. So again, it's as wildlife biologists on public areas, are one of our responsibilities is to provide good hunting experiences. Yeah.
That's kind of like the minimum size, or maybe just like an average size.
For a refuge? One-third.
Like you say, one-third of the area?
Yeah.
I mean, like, what's too small? Is there a too small for somebody's?
Any refuge is better than no refuge, you know, but I probably wouldn't go smaller than a quarter of your area. Yeah. But, you know, that sometimes is hard to get the public to swallow, because especially if it isn't established. And you come in to manage an area and you're like, well, we know that this is good to have a wildlife refuge and have a sanctuary, so for hunting experiences, okay? Going in and establishing that can be very difficult from a political standpoint. If y'all have, you know, as y'all meet different folks, like Willie Atkins down at Hiawassee Refuge, that some of y'all know, has issues with things like this, because duck hunters tend to be very political, and also many of them have political connections, and you're going to manage it the way, as the biologist, the hunter's going to tell you how to manage it. And it just, it's crazy. That's ridiculous. It should be up to the experts. They're not sitting in this damn classroom, and I'm not teaching the duck hunters, and neither are the other professionals that are out there. So you all are learning, you know, information based on 20, 30, 40 years of research. And I'm sorry, but the duck hunters don't know how to manage. Some of them are very well read, but for the most part, you know, that's why you all get degrees and are paid to do it. And I really do have some serious issues with not necessarily hunters, but them calling politicians and politicians putting pressure on biologists. And that comes down through the director of TWRA down to your regional biologist and your boss saying, why don't we just forget about that whole refuge thing? Or let's just forget about having moist soil management. You know, why don't we just... And you know that that's not the most surprising. So those are things that, depending on the, this occurs in a lot of agencies that you just have to deal with, and you have to be tactful with it. But it's we need to evolve and move forward. There's, I still see people managing in 2000, you know, in this century, I see people managing like early 80s, and it just blows my mind, you know. But so five components there. Depending on your area, okay, now you may not be able to have all these five components. I mean, you're dealt the infrastructure you're given. Now, you can add components if you have some management infrastructure. You can change the composition. I mean, I think that's where, you know, you have the greatest capability of impacting and maybe bringing some of these things in, like having a permanent flooded area, having some refuge, agriculture is usually already there, and, you know, doing some moist soil. You know, green tree reservoirs, a lot of times you don't have that opportunity, you just don't have a bottomland area. But some of these you can put in, and there's only so much you can do on the area you have. All right, so that's the ideal management complex. Any questions? Even within one of these, like for example, moist soil management, which we're fixing to go through, we may have six moist soil management units, and we manage those as a complex in themselves based on flooding, the time and duration that we're flooding, the timing and the duration that we're flooding, and also with respect to managing the plant community. So we'll talk about managing even within moist soil the moist soil portion. All right, good? Okay, so let's move on to moist soil management. This is a picture actually down at Noxubee Wildlife Refuge. They have an awesome system of moist soil units down there, which we will go down and we'll talk about. All right, let's just define moist soil wetlands in general, and then specifically with respect to the cording classification system. All right, first of all, moist soil wetlands, okay? We can think of them just very generally as intermittently to seasonally flooded wetlands that are dominated by annual and or perennial herbaceous hydrophytes. So what we're talking about here, intermittently, seasonally flooded wetlands that are dominated by annuals tend to be non-persistent vegetation, and perennials tend to be persistent vegetation. So you're dealing with herbaceous hydrophytes, emergent wetlands. These are emergent wetlands. All right, moist soil wetlands are not your flooded marsh. These are emergent wetlands. Okay, and the hydrology, of course, the hydro period here, how long the water's on, varies a lot in moist soil wetlands naturally. And of course, then part of your job as a manager is that you can manipulate this hydro period to create certain desired plant responses and to provide flooded habitat at different times of the year depending on what species you're focusing on. So, and then we're talking about herbaceous stuff. If we're talking about woody stuff, then it's not moist soil management. Then it's basically hardwood bottomland management, forested wetland management, or green tree reservoir management if you have levees around that system. Okay, good? All right, good. So these are systems that we're talking about here, nice shallowly flooded areas, cetera. We'll have better pictures a little bit later. Now, with respect to Quartan et al., all right, we're in the palustrine system. What class are we in with moist soil wetlands? We're emergent wetlands, that's correct. And we have two subclasses. One is persistent, and then the other is non-persistent, right? I don't know where my little, that thing, it'll probably fly in here in a second. So persistent and non-persistent. Now, bottom line is what we do in moist soil management is we try to manage this community. Generally, your persistent vegetation, you're dealing with rushes. Like, for example, the genus Juncus, okay? Your rushes and cattail and things like that that are more persistent, okay? That are not toppling at the end of the growing season. You also will get vines that are coming in. And over here, we're dealing with grasses and sedges. So we're dealing with plants that are in the genus Panicum, the genus Cyperus, Scopus, okay? Over here, we're dealing with Juncus, and another one that's often, it could be persistent or it could be non-persistent, is the genus Carex, C-A-R-E-X, okay? So, all right, grasses and sedges, rushes and vines, and generally over here with persistent, these are your perennial reproducing species. In other words, they are primarily reproducing every other year with respect to a seed source, and they are primarily reproducing just vegetatively. So they're putting a lot of energy into putting out shoots, okay, as opposed to seed production. On the other side, these are what are called annual plants, your non-persistent plants, and your non-persistent plants are all about producing seed, okay? They're all about producing seed. So they are producing seed 1 year. Big seed producing species. So with respect to us trying to produce seed for waterfowl, this tends to be the subclass that we're trying to manage for. Okay? Trying to keep moist soil wetlands, okay, in this non-persistent subclass. This also represents an earlier stage of succession. Okay, so persistent often travels into non-persistent in the lack or in the absence of disturbance. Okay, and that's where you can actually interject them to keep it in this non-persistent area. We will use types of management to try to do that. One is hydrology, and the second are mechanical manipulations, which primarily deals with disking. And there it comes. So there's a late serial stage and an early serial stage, so an early part of success, late part. Okay, yeah. Burning, we will talk about burning, but generally burning is not an effective management practice in wetlands. It is used in coastal areas often because you can't get in to mechanically manipulate, and we'll talk about some of the benefits of burning, but the setback succession in general, burning is not effective at setting back succession. See, what you need to do is you need to break the seed bank and expose. As we get from, we go from a non-persistent community to a persistent community. The other thing about persistent plants is they're, I want to say allelopath, that's not right. Allelopath. They produce toxins. Is that right, allelopathic? Yeah, golly, yeah, I haven't said that word in a long time. So basically, they can retard, the growth of other plants, okay? And so really what you need to do to release these plants is you can burn it, all right, but those, your persistent plants are going to come right back and be on top of these annuals. So what you need to do is you can burn it. We'll talk about when you might want to burn. But what you have to do to get it back here is you need to disk. You need to break that that soil. You need to expose those seeds. And these guys can germinate faster and grow faster than these guys if you give them a chance. Yeah?
You said the annuals produce
Yeah.
The perennials, what is that, tubers or inverts?
Yeah, they aren't producing, in general, they aren't producing, this is generally has a lower carrying capacity altogether, okay? So they are producing some seed. And some of these plants, yes, they have roots and tubers that if you have it shallowly flooded enough, the birds may eat. Invertebrate production is, it depends. There's more lignin in the leaf material of these plants, and invertebrates generally have a harder time breaking it down than with these plants. So when you flood grasses and sedges, there's really good invert production in there as well. So usually what we do is we try to keep it here, because you're going to get both good annual seed production, plus when you flood it up, you're going to get good invert production. Now, some of the species here are not too bad, and specifically it's the genus Polygonum, smartweeds. Smartweeds have okay seed production, but they have a nice big leafy structure, and invertebrate production in smartweed wetlands, which again is getting towards this later persistent vegetation, is not too bad, actually. Okay, so smartweed. Any other questions? Okay, good. All right. Oh yeah, there you go. There's a smartweed right there. So the hydroperiod, the water regime we're talking about, this is just a natural regime, but we basically manipulate it to do whatever we want to do. Now, it usually isn't flooded any longer than seasonally. And again, this is the cordon classification system of the cordon words for their regime. Seasonally means basically by the end of the growing season, there's no water, okay? That's seasonally flooded. So that would be as wet as a moist soil wetland gets. Usually they're dry by the fall, and then either fall rains or winter rains fill them back up, or through management, you flood them. Okay? And then some of them dry, they're just flooded for short periods of time in the spring or in early summer and go dry. Consequently, you get a lot of herbaceous plant growth. All right, so a moist soil management unit is basically just a moist soil wetland that's surrounded by some levees and has a water control structure, and that allows you to manipulate the water levels. That is all that it is, okay? So it looks something like this. Here, this is down at Noxby Wildlife Refuge. That's a levee there, okay? You can see a levee coming up here. And basically, the low end of the field, as you can see from the water, it's right there, and there's a water control structure. We'll actually go right there and stand right there and talk about this particular impoundment. And so sometimes, depending on how your moist soil unit is structured, this is a very large one, a pretty large one here. In general, the smaller your moist soil unit, generally the better, okay? You generally never want to flood more than 2 1-foot contours, okay? Because, again, what did we talk about? When it comes to dabbling ducks, right there, you want it shallowly flooded, 2 feet deep at the most, okay? So if you're traversing more than 2 contours, that's probably too big. And it's ideal if these levees are along contours as opposed to just being, you know, making a square unit. And now, in order, okay, yeah. The topographic contours. So you really don't want any more than 2 1-foot contours within a moist soil unit. Now, many times that's not the case, because a lot of impoundments that you would manage now were built back in the 80s. And back then, basically, nobody really thought about how deeply things should be flooded or not flooded, and even following along the contour. So often what you have is you have an impoundment that's square, and it may go across the elevational gradient. And let's see here. So the ideal design for a moist soil unit is, this is just a natural, contour. All right, and you may have a unit like this where this is 1 foot. Here's your control structure here. So it's 2 foot deep down here, and as you flood up, it's 1 foot. By the time it hits this next contour, it's just shallowly flooded over here. Okay? That's the ideal scenario. That's not always the case, because often, you may cross five contours. And so when you flood the darn thing up to get it flooded up in here, it's 5 foot deep down here. And that's too deep for dabbling ducks, although that doesn't mean that if you're in this scenario, you're in a bad situation. Because what you can do is slowly flood it, okay, and just bring it up and flood it 1 foot deep. This area is good habitat. Then the next month, put another foot of water in, flood it up and hit the next contour. Next month, flood it, flood the next contour, etc. You definitely don't want to go ahead and flood the whole damn thing in the first month. That doesn't make any sense, because if you're producing food down here, you've just buried it in water. Nothing's going to be able to access it. Okay? Yeah. That's exactly right. As it gets deeper here, you will have some of those open, nice open water areas down here that can be used by dabbling or diving ducks or roosting or what have you. But I certainly wouldn't go ahead and flood this deep right at the beginning. Now, what I would also just contest is that you should have some permanently flooded marsh areas that specifically are focusing on diving duck habitat that have, because this is not going to provide a whole lot of good diving duck habitat, because it's not going to have nice submergent aquatic plants. But they'll use it in some regard. Okay, so a moist soil management complex, then it's just simply a group of these units where you can independently manage each of them, the hydrology within each of them. Now this is Noxubee Wildlife Refuge, and you can see they have 9 impoundments. This impoundment here is this impoundment, okay, just flipped around. All right, so that levee is that levee there. All right, now the important thing, now this is a little bit better. You can see how these follow the contours here, and they're smaller. In general, your impoundment should never be larger than 50 acres, and they should be less than that. 25 acres, 10 acres, again, the size of your impoundment should be based on the contours. So you definitely shouldn't have much more than a 50 acre impoundment. Although there are, Tennessee National has impoundments. Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge has impoundments that are several hundred acres in size. That makes it a challenge to manage the water levels. It's hard to see across an impoundment that large. So you want to be able to manipulate your water levels and have a good control over those. Okay, so in order to, again, one of the things we were talking about is hydrological management or hydrology management. And so in order to do that, you need water. Well, again, this is the ideal scenario. The ideal scenario is that you have something like a river that you can basically divert the water into your units here, and you can shunt water around. Or you have something like this, which is a reservoir. This is called Ross Branch Reservoir. And it's about 12 foot deep, and whenever they want to flood these areas, they just let water down through this water supply canal, and actually this canal goes all the way through here. So they can just keep everything open, and let's say they want to keep all these units dry. They can just flow water all the way through and hit 8, or they can actually shunt it off and send it into these other units if they want. Okay, so that's a really kind of an ideal scenario. Because you don't want to flood all your units at the same time. Well, again, at the very end, we'll talk about, hey, what if we had a scenario like this? What would we do with respect to flooding? All right. So, any questions? All right. So let's talk about hydrologic management. There are two aspects of hydrology management. One is drawing things down and one is flooding things up, right? So the first thing we talk about is drawing it down, which is generally in the spring. Why are we drawing it down in the spring? Because we had it flooded during the winter for the birds to use it, right? So spring drawdowns, usually they fall into two categories based on duration and on date. Okay, there are two things you can do. All right, the duration refers to the rate in which you draw it down. You can do a fast drawdown, which means literally pulling the water off as fast as you can, like within a couple of days. And then the other is a drawdown between 2 to 3 weeks. All right, I'll tell you right now, there really, unless it's an emergency because a levee blew and you know, you got to divert water very quickly, you never do a fast drawdown. Never. There is no reason to do it, although a fast drawdown is what a lot of folks do. They just want to get the water off and they don't want to deal with it. All right? You want to bring the water down slow. So I know that you all saw drop board structures. What you're talking about doing here is you're talking about taking one or two boards off at a time and just let it come down nice slow, let the water stabilize, and that does several things. Okay, as you bring the water down slow, that exposes flooded habitat, okay, stuff that's been flooded for all winter, those plants that grew during the summer, okay, and have been flooded for most of the winter are going to be mostly decomposed. So as you're drawing it down, you're exposing mudflat habitat. This is in the spring. What does that help with? Shorebirds migrating back through, you know. So you're providing shorebird habitat. The other thing is that your waterfowl are still hanging around and they're still acquiring food resources during migration. And what it does is you bring it down nice and slowly, you consolidate food resources, especially aquatic inverts. And you just, that large volume of water gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the birds can effectively get in those areas and wear it out, and you're giving them good food resources. So slow is always better. The other thing from a nutrient standpoint, if you yank everything out, you're going to lose a lot of organic nutrients. It's going to flow out through your water control structure and down into some aquatic system, so that you want to keep those nutrients on site so that it naturally fertilizes the moist soil well. Okay, also as you bring it down slower, as things are drying out, the seeds in that seed bank are going to begin to germinate. And depending on the dates in which you germinate and at what time as far as plants, you end up getting a greater plant diversity responding by bringing it nice down nice and slow. That's a good thing. High plant diversity generally means you have high nutritional diversity. A lot of different types of plants, a lot of different types of seeds. Hence, you have a greater capability of meeting the energetic needs of a variety of waterfowl species the following year. So talking about drawing it down so we can produce plants for the next fall. All right? And, okay, good. Now, with respect to date, you can do it early or you can do it late. Now, in this group, you want to have some where you do it early and you want to have some where you do it late. The early ones, again, one of the reasons in doing it early is that the plant species that respond during that early drawdown are going to be different than during a late drawdown. I will tell you that if you're ever having a problem with exotic plants, do a late drawdown because you want to stress the hell out of everything. hold the water on, hold it. Don't give them a chance. The later you hold it, you are giving the competitive advantage to those moist soil plants, because late in the year they will still germinate very quickly, especially the sedges, cyperus, the genus cyperus, and your grasses, panicums, echinocloa, the millets will still germinate and have time. You know, they can mature in 60 days. Okay, they'll have time to reach maturation by the time you're interested in flooding them back up for waterfowl. So a late drawdown, in general, a late drawdown tends to promote more annual producing plants, okay? It tends to, okay? But it doesn't mean that an early drawdown is not a good idea, because again, you want that diversity with respect to the plant community. In general, if you're in early state of succession, which we'll talk about managing that, and you do an early drawdown, you're going to still get annual plants responding in that early drawdown. Yeah?
But if you wait until late, wouldn't most of your shorebirds be gone by that time?
Okay, yeah. Well, there are a couple things. As far as doing a late drawdown, what is the interest here in doing that late drawdown? Things this does. It produces more annual plants. Only annual plants are going to respond because it's too late in the growing season. That's one thing. Secondly, when you start doing this drawdown in July, well, now you have shorebirds coming back the other way in fall migration. So you're exposing mudflat habitat here for fall migrants for shorebirds. So that's a good thing. Also, by doing this late drawdown here, you definitely have provided flooded habitat for amphibians, and many of those species, the tadpoles, as you slowly bring it down, and that's another important thing, that slow drawdown is critical so that you don't end up having catastrophic tadpole mortality. Most tadpoles, they develop for 2 months, but after a month, they're far enough along in development that if you slowly bring the water down, that will cue them to go into metamorphosis. Okay, they'll go from what's called pre-metamorphosis to pro-metamorphosis to metamorphic climax. And if you bring it down too fast, they can't do it. They just physiologically can't do it, unless they're desert-adapted species like spadefoots are. Yeah. Well, I'd still bring it down slow. That's fine. I mean, July 1st, you start bringing it down and do it over 2 weeks. Oh, you're fine. And again, you're providing that nice that mudflat habitat for shorebirds. So, oh yeah, you're still fine. Again, you can start in July, and even if you did it over an entire month. August is early enough for annual producing plants, annual grasses, to actually germinate and respond and seed out by the time we hit senescence in late October. Yeah. That is the nice thing about being in the South, is that you really have that, you know, doing a drawdown in July is still fine. And the other cool thing about that, again, is you're providing, that late drawdown gives you shorebird habitat, and it provides habitat for breeding amphibians. It also provides habitat for breeding waterfowl. So again, in Tennessee, you know, we have wood ducks, we have gansers, and well, they're not out there breeding in the emergent wetlands. However, they will take their broods there, and they'll raise their broods in that emergent, well, in the moist soil wetland that's sitting out there. Okay, and they'll be eating the inverts, etc. So this, by doing a late drawdown, there are a lot of benefits, although again, you don't want to do all these late. You want to have some early so that you provide that spring habitat. Okay, you're consolidating food resources for spring migrating waterfowl, and also you're exposing mudflats for shorebirds. And then you have your late drawdown as well for the other groups that we just talked about. All right. So it's good to have some of both. Any questions? Yeah. You know, I don't know if there's a really good response to that. That's a good question. I am an advocate of late drawdowns. Now, this can be a problem, especially if you need to get in and you need to do some levee work or water control structure work. You can also have issues with beavers getting in there and damming everything up and messing around with your structures the longer you hold water in. And so a lot of managers like to just draw it down early and so they don't have to deal with the beavers. So there are other issues that come that are involved in doing a late drawdown, although with respect to managing birds, I like late drawdowns. And so what I would do is I would have about probably, you know, a third of my impoundments go early and then two-thirds late. Now, the other thing let's see here, what else do we have? Oh, yeah. This whole eco-trap, that means ecological trap, that's talking about drawing down late and resulting in catastrophic events like killing all the tadpoles. So again, you want to bring it down nice and slow so they have time to metamorphose. The other thing is that if you do have ducklings that are being brooded in that area, you want to bring it down slow so they have time to move to another area, and hopefully there's some permanent area, permanent wetland areas nearby. Because if you pull the plug and they don't have any other place to go, then that's it with your ducklings. They won't be along around very long. Okay, so it's good to have multiple combinations, except fast is not good unless you just have to do it for some type of maintenance thing. All right, good. Okay, now. Depending on the amount of precipitation that you get, etc., you may need to irrigate your moist soil areas. In general, in the southeast, this is not an issue. We get enough rainfall in the summer, and things are nice and lush, and there's plenty of rainfall, unless we're in a drought year. And in those cases, it is good to shallowly flood your moist soil areas. Again, if you have some permanent water source like a reservoir or a river, you can divert it. You want to do it shallow. If you overtop wetland plants, hydrophytes, you will kill them. All right, they still have to respire. You know, there isn't anything special about them. They still do need oxygen. They can withstand their roots being flooded, but if you overtop any hydrophyte, you're going to kill a thing unless it's an aquatic plant. All right. So again, shallowly flooded, meaning that you want the soil moist. And all you need to do is put that water on for a couple weeks, that's all. So you can just flow it in there, you can let it sit in there for a while, and just moisten that up, and you can completely offset drought, okay? And you can tell, I mean, not getting very much rain, but if you look out there in June or July, and your plants are wilting, what these plants will do, if you don't get on it right away, is that just naturally they will seed out in June. And they'll be about this tall and they'll produce just a little bit of seed. Okay, but if you notice that and you catch it and you put water on there, they'll just keep growing. And you can offset that drought. All right, what else? Yes, that's it. Okay, so now we talk about winter flooding. Now what do we do? We're ready. When do we start flooding in the winter? Well, this is the rule to follow, all right? The slogan I use is slow and sequential. Slow and sequential. Just like we drew down slow, we flood up slow, all right? And the reason is just like I talked about over there, especially if you have multiple contours that you're crossing, is that you want to flood those sites because, again, if it's over 2 foot deep, most of your waterfowl species are not going to be able to acquire those food resources. Okay? So slow and sequential. Bring it up nice and slow. And sequential means when you have a complex, like six, maybe like six units or something, you don't flow them all at the same time. All right? You choose, like maybe the ones that you drew down, probably the early, your early draw down here, those are one of the first that you start flooding. And again, you start doing this in September. This is when your blue-winged teal are coming through and your early migrants. So you start to flood these up in September. And generally, again, this is to help those birds. The majority of waterfowl are going to be in Tennessee in November and December and January and February. So you don't want to flood them all up. Maybe just one of your impoundments you flood up early and you just do it nice and slow. All right. The other thing is generally your boss is going to tell you, why are you flooding the damn thing up in September? Nobody's hunting around here, is if you're on a game area. Okay? You're wasting food. I mean, there's dollars going into that. We should just be flooding during the hunting season. Some issues you have to deal with. The bottom line is, though, is that we are not also just here just to produce opportunities to kill animals. All right? We are here as biologists to provide habitat for the suite of birds that come through and may use our areas, including the early migrants such as blue-winged teal. Now, is there an early blue-winged teal season here? There isn't. Okay, some states have that. There is an early goose season and an early wood duck season, so this could provide hunting opportunities even then. Is there an early blue-wing season? Wood duck, but blue wings? It might be. I don't know. Yeah. You might be able to shoot blue wings, yeah. A lot of times you can hunt blue wings. It's about the only time you get to hunt them in the United States because they fly through in September and they hit Mexico and the Caribbean and farther south. Okay, so this can still work into a hunting scheme if necessary. So, all right, and again, you always want to flood less than 2 feet. That's the thing to remember. No more than two contours, ideally. And if you are going to do, that's just the way your impoundment is, that's the way it is, all right? just do it slowly. And I'd flood it. If you had a deal like this, I would flood a contour about every 2 to 4 weeks and just slowly flood it on up, okay? Now, that is something also that when you begin to think about, hey, what do I want to do to my area? Let's see if I can get some dollars from the regional office or from the state office, or if you're working for the feds, you know, the main regional office with Fish and Wildlife Service, is that you can begin to think about, well, I'm flooding 5 contours here. What I want is to put a contour levee in between here so I can have a better control over my hydrology and have this broken up so I can independently manage those with respect to hydrology. So those are things to think about if you're depending on your area that you may inherit. All right. Any questions? Let's see, what does that say? Oh yeah, starting in September. Okay. All right. Good. So that was a lot of information, but hopefully that gives you a good feel there. I mean, that's hydrology management 101. And a lot of this research was done by Lee Fredrickson over at Mississippi State and all his grad students through the 80s and in the 90s. Okay. Now, drawdown. I'm just going to take you through a little pictorial representation. So what we're talking about in the spring, here's your typical flashboard riser, drop board structure. You're pulling that water, those boards out. Again, one at a time, you know, two at most at a time. Just drop it down nice and slow. Water's coming out. You're getting nice exposed mud flats for your shorebirds. You're consolidating food resources for both waterfowl and shorebirds. And then you're exposing the seeds on the ground germinate in that nice seed bank, germinate and ultimately that you have plants responding. And the again, the net primary productivity in these wetlands is amazing. All right, you can have extremely dense growth. Now this is showing irrigation during the summer to offset drought. And so that's a possibility. Again, another way, this is actually irrigating that we were doing in a playa wetland. So out there, they're actually using aquifer water to irrigate this moist soil area. So you can, that's another possibility, using a well, using the aquifer as opposed to surface water, or if you don't have it. Okay. Now, veg responses. Okay, this is a representative of sort of an early state of succession, some capacity. This is Lyrsia. This is rice cut grass. And this is Polygonum. Polygonum is a smart weed. Again, this is starting to get towards later in succession, but it's primarily dominated by grasses. Let's see what else we have in there. It's kind of hard to see anything else. All right, early to mid succession, then you start to get this is smart weed. You start to see this type of system. Here are some grasses here. This is millet, okay, barnyard grass, Echinocloa crucigale. And you start to see these grasses, bunch grasses, you see less and less of them, and you see more and more of, again, this is Cyperus erythrorhizos, which is a pretty good seed-producing species, but you have a lot more smartweed in there coming in, and so you start to see this later in succession. Then finally, when you get to late succession, it's just dominated by smartweed often, and you also start getting woody species such as maples, willows, and ash or something like that that may be wetland. So we want to prevent us from getting to this point. It is good to have a diversity of cereal stages because, again, there are different plants that are present at different cereal stages, which, again, adds to that nutritional diversity that's important for meeting the needs of a variety of species of waterfowl. Okay, but generally you don't want to move past early to mid. So what do we do? Well, no, we don't do that at all yet. So next slide. So then you have these areas like so, and then you flood the areas up, maybe using water from a reservoir. In a lot of cases, you may not even have a permanent water source, and you're just basically putting boards in, and you're waiting for it to rain. That's kind of the worst case scenario you can be in, because you have very little control over your water. You just have to wait for it to rain. Ideally, you want to have some control. So you're flowing water in, and then the birds flock in. And moist soil areas are awesome areas. They can be extremely highly productive with respect to kilograms of food produced per hectare when seeds and inverts. These are geese coming in a shallow moist soil area, and these are ducks. I mean, you get all waterfowl species really responding. Generally, geese like it more open, though. They won't land right in that thick vegetation, but the ducks will, at least in some capacity. So the foods we're talking about here, this is, again, millet. This is one of your species you need to know. Barnyard grass, Echinocloa crucigale, good seed. This is a good plant here. And when I handed out your plant list, has on there whether things are good or not good for waterfowl, and it indicates whether it's seed or whether it's tubers they're getting. So again, that's just for reference. You don't need to remember all that stuff. But this is one really good one. Inverts, of course, being produced, and then there are tubers that you have from your perennial plants. Okay, that are also eaten by waterfowl. So those are the three main food types that you get in a moist soil unit: seeds, inverts, and some tubers. All right, now this is water control structures, and I know I am aware that you all saw some water control structures. and maybe even got a little bit bored with them. Unfortunately, you're going to see a lot more of them. We're going to talk a lot more of them because of wetland ecology, and this is how we do our job. So this is the most basic one, and you generally see these. They're called flashboard risers, or they're called dropboard water control structures. These generally are for small moist soil units, moving no more than, in general, 20, 30 acre moist soil area. But again, they shouldn't be much bigger than that. Your moist soil unit shouldn't be much bigger than that. So these should always be pretty much what you're using. And it's ideal because you can really micromanage the water levels in the spring and in the fall. And ideally, you can see these are tongue groove boards. These things work great for stopping water seepage. There are other techniques which you probably have heard of if your boards are leaking, which is putting like some sawdust in front of the boards, and it'll actually clog up the where it's leaking in the boards, in between the boards. Black plastic, things like that are also used. But these tongue and groove are awesome. You don't have to deal with the whole sawdust thing, which just is a mess and a pain in the butt. The only problem with tongue and groove is if you end up having a large structure, okay? If you have a nice small structure like this, you don't have a lot of head pressure with the water, it's a piece of cake. And I will give you all a handout on how to design these. We built several of these down in Puerto Rico, and also how you design the hook. You put a hook around here. It comes down, it hooks here. You can see the steel peg. It grabs on, and you put a hook around there and a hook around this side, and you just pull it up and yank it up. And it's pretty darn easy. And if you're holding a lot of water, that pressure can be a challenge in trying to get your boards up. So you may see other types of structures, and we'll talk about those, that when you have a lot more water that you're holding. And again, these are also good because you can just take a board out at a time. You can walk away. You take a board out, you walk away, you come back the next couple days, take another board out or whatever. You really can honestly micromanage your water levels. Now, these are some other structures that are often used for larger units with more water pressure pushing on the structure. This is a screw gate structure. The problem with this is that you open it and you gotta come back and close the damn thing. And it's basically two levels, on, off, all right? So that's the problem with the screw gate, is you really, you lose that micromanaging capability. All right, these things also, man, they break and they leak, and they can just be a pain in the butt. So you do see those a lot. You can see them even at a larger scale. This is a coastal marsh down in Louisiana where they have these huge screw gates allowing coastal input and fluctuations of water levels, and using salinity to influence the plant community, etc., which I know you already heard about, so I won't talk about that. All right, this is another thing that you often see in tidal systems. This is called a flap gate. And a flap gate is basically you have the tide coming in and it pushes it open, and then when the tide goes out, it closes and it holds the water there. Okay, so it's another way of basically influencing and holding water when the tide comes in, and using that salinity, and then you can just keep it closed if you don't want to use that water. Any questions? Moving water. This is ideal. The cheaper, the better. Part of being a manager, and unfortunately, we don't get into this too much, although I will provide you some dollar figures on how much it costs to manage later on. You always have to, as a manager, you're going to have to think about how expensive it is to pump your water here or do this or do that or put that type of structure in. It's just part of it. Those are things that you learn. and part of the on-the-job training you can get from internships, etc. But the cheapest and the best way is just by flowing it via gravity. So you have your permanent water source on the high end of your units, and you're just flowing it down. You're just flowing it from a reservoir or, again, a river. You know, another possibility, again, is pumping, all right, using diesel or PTO-driven pumps or wells. So, let me see here. I don't know. Yeah, here's a PTO pump. So there are two brands of PTO pumps that you commonly see and you hear folks using. One is called a Crisafoli pump, that's a brand name, and the other is a Gator pump. And basically you can, if you have a permanent water source here, you hook it up to the trail, your tractor. This shaft hooks up to the PTO, the power takeoff of your tractor. You kick in the power takeoff, it starts to turn that axle. That axle turns, there's a big propeller on there, and it basically sucks water up and pumps it through the, you can see the metal portion goes down into the permanent water source, and then here you have a flexible tube in which you can actually put several of these together to pump it a fair amount of distance, generally not more than 100 feet, before you really are losing water pressure to such a point that it's not even reasonable to use it. So for pumping short distances, it works pretty good. And these are good pumps to have on any refuge if you're pumping short distances. Electrical pumps, you know, those are really kind of the granddaddy of them all. Those are nice. You just come on out, you turn on a pump and pump water from one area to another. And I do have some cost of that. Yep. Yeah. Going pretty much from cheapest to actually this is probably the next as far as diesel-powered pumps from a well are probably the next expensive than, electric. Now, I will tell you this. Let me back up. To put an electric pump in is very expensive because you often have to run electricity or not. If you can tap off of existing electricity, good. In general, electrical pumps, when I was looking at those prices back in late 1990s, the difference was something like $65,000 compared to like $25,000 for a diesel-powered pump. However, once you get things running, it's cheaper for electricity than it is for diesel fuel. So it's a good investment if you have that capability. All right, here are some websites here, Crisafoli's website as well as Gator Pump's website for these towable ones. Which, even if you have these capabilities, it's always good to have a towable pump. Okay, you will use it. All right, so now we've talked about drawdowns, and certainly drawdowns can influence our plant species. Again, early drawdowns tend to favor more perennial plants, and later drawdowns tend to favor more annual plants. Now we talk about even influencing that state of succession through other types of management techniques, one of those being mechanical manipulations. So we did some research, and these are different types of manipulations that people talk about: disking, tilling, which is like a rototiller. I think I have a picture of that. You can scrape with a dozer, and then you just are going in and mowing areas. And the primary goal here, again, is the setback succession. In general, you are going out and you're assessing your plant community. You're looking to see if it's getting towards more perennial plants. But usually going in there about every 2 to 3 years, every 3 years is probably just fine, okay? In Tennessee, as you get farther south, southern Mississippi and stuff, you might need to be on top of it a little bit, even a little bit more every couple years. But every 3 years is fine. Definitely no longer than every five. By 5 years, you're going to see woody plants coming in. All right. So now, historically, I'm going to tell you the history of this because many folks still manage this way, all right? And historically, disking, mechanical manipulations, whatever they were always done in the spring, all right? And I will suggest that there's a better way to do it. All right, usually it's done immediately following spring drawdown or as soon as you can get in there without getting your tractor stuck. Now, this is my suggestion, and that is autumn manipulations. We did some research at Mississippi State, which I'll share some of those results with you, that showed that autumn manipulations are as effective, if not more effective. You get multiple benefits from autumn manipulations than you do from spring manipulation. So we can set back succession by doing manipulations in the fall. And I would suggest that's what this is the best approach to implement. Okay, now autumn manipulations again. As soon as possible after early or late drawdowns. Well, really, I don't know what the heck that is talking about. Oh, okay. Historically, again, this is the historical approach directly after a drawdown. In the Southeast, just in general, the reason why we started looking into autumn manipulations is because in the Southeast, precipitation levels tend to be relatively high. A lot of times you can't get, if you do a spring drawdown even, you can't get in to an area, or you do a late draw, you can't get in with your tractor. It rains too much in the summer. So you end up being delayed until September or October to do a mechanical manipulation. So just because of our climate, we tend to be delayed. Also, because of these other important groups of birds that we need to think about, such as providing late drawdowns with shorebirds and providing habitat for amphibians and also for breeding waterfowl. So anyways, there are lots of reasons why, first of all, we want to do a late drawdown, okay, that we already talked about. And correspondingly, it's pretty wet out there. It'll take a while for it to dry out, for things to germinate and things like that. So why not just go in there in the fall and do your manipulations? Okay. Again, historically, they're always done in the spring. Now, the other benefit of doing fall manipulations is that in the Southeast, because of our long growing season and the nice humid climate conditions, decent amount of rain, these moist-soil areas can be extremely productive and can produce dense and continuous stands of moist-soil plants. If you flood those plants up, it can, and it's just a dense stand, many birds will not use those dense stands. Okay, it needs to be opened up some. So what you can do by doing autumn manipulations is you can go in and you can actually open up these dense stands while setting back succession. And we'll kind of talk about that. When we do these manipulations, we do not want to take an entire moist soil unit and do the whole darn thing. We want to do it in patches, okay? And so we'll talk about how we may actually do that. But that there it's a kind of a double benefit. So the secondary goal here we're setting back succession, but also in the Southeast with those dense stands that are developed, it helps provide waterfowl access once those areas are flooded after you do your autumn manipulation. Yeah.
Okay, so after the water can draw down, in the fall, mm-hmm. these are pretty dry, so you can actually drive a tractor without getting stuck on it, right?
Correct.
So wouldn't this also negatively affect your amphibian populations that are underground?
Well, it is possible, yeah.
That's a lot of disturbance.
Yeah.
They're burrowed right close to wetlands, so you're going to be disking up their wintering habitat.
It is possible. A lot of, honestly, we don't know. There is no research that indicates, nobody has looked at amphibian use of moist soil wetlands. It would depend on the species. A lot of the species, when they are going to overwinter or what have you, they may or may not be burrowed down right in that area when the water came off, right in that wetland. By the time you're drawing off that lake, a lot of the adults have already bred and they've gone up into higher terrestrial areas, forested areas maybe adjacent, or they're burrowed down in those areas. They're not really associated. Now your metamorphs, your metamorphs are going to be really close to the water, and they may burrow down into cracks and things like that, and you may disc some up. That is a possibility. But that's part of it. There's no research that indicates one way or another. But we do have to set back succession at some time. And, I don't know. I'm just trying to think, if you did it in the spring, would you get less of that? Maybe so, just because maybe you don't have any amphibian habitat because you pulled the plug. Yeah. So maybe if you pull the plug early, the less chance of amphibians being around. But yeah. In general, what my gut feeling is to say is probably I doubt if it would be that big of an impact. The other thing is we've gone into areas and definitely disced. I've seen farmers disc Playa Lakes and disc around Playa Lakes, and amphibians get exposed. Well, unless the disc cuts them in half, they just dig right back down. And I guess that's, you might lose some amphibians. So. All right. Now, I'll tell you right now is that for managing moist soil areas, disc is the best mechanical manipulation to do. It's the cheapest to do, and it's the most effective at setting back succession. Okay? So I know that you learned a lot about burning and how burning's the most wonderful tool in the world, right? Okay, well, not in wetland management. It can be useful in some capacities, and we'll talk about that. All right, so why forego manipulations until autumn? Well, we've already talked about a lot of those things. Again, providing breeding habitat for resident waterfowl, also providing habitat for amphibians, shorebird habitat when you do those late drawdown. Doing a late drawdown. Also, again, this is a tractor that we buried down in Puerto Rico, not necessarily in the southeast, but again, similar situations where it's just too wet. You have to wait for things to dry out to the fall to get in there and to pull a disc. And then again, this dense vegetation that can establish, it's good to go in there and to open it up, at least some areas, so birds have landing areas. And then once the birds can land, they'll go in and they'll knock down the other vegetation and acquire those food resources. So the different types of mechanical manipulate here, again, we have disking. I don't know if do I have the other ones. There's tilling. This is done usually, you rarely see this on a management area. This is often just done in horticulture areas, but it's a tiller. And they work pretty good, except they get caught up with vegetation real easily, just like your own rototiller. And they can really pulverize the soil, but plus they're not very wide. So a disc is the best. You can do mowing and things. Mowing may be the most appropriate. So what about disking? How many disc paths are necessary? Well, usually 1 to 3 times is sufficient, okay? 1 to 3 times. All right, and the other thing is what you want, the best disc to have is an offset disc. An offset disc is one where you have two groups of blades. You have blades in the front and you have blades in the back, and one set of blades is turned this way, the other set of blades is turned this way, and they're offset, so as you peel as the ground is broken, it peels over one way, the other disc is peeling and cutting it the other way. And those are the best for pulverizing pulverizing soil. And that's what you want to do. And what you see right here, that is not enough. If you run a disc over and you see all this vegetation, this detritus in here, that's not good enough. You want to go over it enough time so you have a nice exposed area for the seeds to germinate, okay? Now, when is burning good, all right? One of the reasons why you may burn is to burn off this vegetation. If it grows very, very dense, if you burn it, then you can cut it real easily with a disc. Burning also releases nutrients, which help with wetland productivity. So, depending on how thick your vegetation is, the type of vegetation you have, one time may be good. It might need to be up to 2 feet. And if it's hurt, you might want to run a fire through it. Let's take a break, all right? Then we'll talk about some research we did in Mississippi.